Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the naturalist, with another great show on the air. With I have a special guest today. My usual partner, Carol Butler, is winging her way right now as we speak to the Galapagos Islands, and it's a great place to go. If you've never been there, it's one of the best trips you can take on all the earth, because it's such a fantastic place. So my other, my friend Saul is here today, who's who writes articles for Audubon, his local Audubon chapter, and he's the president of his local Audubon chapter. So Saul, say hi to everybody.
Hi, everyone.
And Saul's going to do the second half of a show that we did on evolution and speciation and allopatric, and what's the other Patrick guy's name?
The other Patrick is Sim.
Sim Patrick. And you know, Patrick Martins is the guy who runs this whole operation. So we won't talk too much about Patrick Martins today. Okay? So we're just going to talk about these things. So, Saul, why don't you take over where we left off last time and give us a little recap.
Okay. In the prior show, we gave a few examples of how species form. The reason I thought this was worth doing a show on is that people just don't see this. It's not an everyday occurrence. It's not something that you can readily watch. It's like watching the grass grow, as I said before. Oftentimes it's very slow, but as we're going to see, sometimes it occurs pretty quickly. And so we had a couple of examples. I think we ended with the sockeye salmon forming two groups, one that stays in the river and one that stays in the lake. And we talked about two different ways of forming species, those Patrick ways. One refers to living in the same place, sympatric, and the other refers to living differently, allopatric. So it's easy to see how organisms can split, how one group can split into two if you have a physical barrier between them, and then they start adapting in different ways, go off and become different species. It's a little harder to see how one group still living together can split, even though they're still living in the same place. But we have examples of that too. And in fact, the one that I'm going to give you now, I like to call one fish, two fish. What is that, Bernie? That's a Dr. Seuss book, right?
Yeah, one fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish. I remember that, Jack. You remember that as a kid? Right. So it's a famous children's story, but it didn't have much to do with evolution.
No.
So we'll just mention it as a good, catchy title.
Right, but my one fish, two fish has to do with evolution, and it's a specific example of what we call sympatric speciation. That is, organisms that are still living together yet, individuals for getting separating and forming two species. And this occurred in a lake in Nicaragua. This is a fairly young lake. It was formed from a collapsed volcano, a caldera, about 20,000 years ago. And when you come to this lake, you see these two species of cichlid fish. That's a type of fish Most of them are pretty nasty. I keep tropical fish, and some of them have names like Jack Dempsey, Red Terror. So you get an idea of what these fish are like.
Can they hang out together with no problems?
Yeah, they can. But if you have more than one fish of the same species, they do quite a bit. They're very aggressive. In fact, if you've heard, you've probably heard of freshwater angelfish in tropical tanks.
Yeah.
They're also cichlid fish. But they can exist in a community tank with other fish. And the reason is their disposition is not as bad as these other cichlids. And that's why they're called angelfish.
Oh, they're so...
They're relatively angels, angelic.
Angelic, right.
So anyway, these two species of cichlids live in this Nicaraguan lake. And they're very closely related, but they look a little different. One species has a deep body with big, tough jaws. And the other is longer and narrower with elongated jaws. And even though they live together, they don't mate. And if you look at their stomach contents, you see that they feed differently. The one with the big heavy jaws feeds mostly on the bottom near the shore. And it eats plants and it also crushes snails. The other one stays in the middle of the lake where it's very deep and eats insects at the surface. And if you look at the DNA from these two fish, you see that the two of them, while they're very similar, are different from all the other fish in the nearby lakes. And the best explanation for this, and scientists agree now, this was discovered about 5-6 years ago, scientists agree that this is the best explanation, that one of these fish somehow got to this lake, maybe from a hurricane, got swept up. I remember reading when I was a kid about Ripley's Believe It or Not and hurricanes actually sucking fish up and depositing them in lakes where they didn't exist before. Well, one of them ended up in this lake, the deeper, heavier-bodied one, and it split off into the other fish, the slender one called the arrow cichlid. The first one is called the Midas cichlid. How long did this take? Well, I told you the lake is only 20,000 years old. The scientists estimate that this could have happened anywhere from 2,000 to 10,000 years. And what they have a fancy name for it. They call it assertative mating due to microhabitat preference.
Sounds like a scientific paper, really.
Yes.
Probably put it on the front of the New York Times. But not on the Post.
It was in the New York Times, actually, a few years ago.
Right.
Here's another one, another form, another new species. This one I had a lot of fun with. Right here in New York City, maybe in your very own home, there's a new species of American cockroach.
Uh-oh.
And this came about a couple of years ago. Two high school students were doing a science project to identify organisms by a new technique called DNA barcoding. And let me explain that technique for a moment. You know, every item that you have that you buy in the supermarket has a barcode, and they scan that on the computer. Well, molecular biologists have been able to devise a technique to collect a small portion of the DNA of an organism. And that DNA is a small segment of just 648 units. We have 3 billion units in our DNA, but this is just 648. And that differs a lot from species to species. So if you isolate that piece and you can color code each of the four letters of the subunits that make up the DNA, and you separate these subunits, you get a barcode. And in fact, just last year, in 2011, it's now 2012, so I have to say last year, the U.S. Department of Agriculture approved this technique for showing what kind of fish you're actually eating. You know, when you go in a restaurant and they tell you that you're eating swordfish, well, anywhere from 25 to 50% of the time, it's not swordfish. It's something cheaper. And it may not be the restaurant that's doing the scam. It may be the fish seller that's doing the scam. But now, all you need is a tiny tissue from the fish, and that's what the USDA has approved. You can take a tiny tissue from the fish, do this procedure, which only takes a few minutes, and you can get a barcode and look it up on the computer and determine exactly what species of fish this is.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that while waiting in line at McDonald's or fish
well, but the
pre-
no, but the prediction is if you're going to a high-end restaurant, they are certainly going to post these things because they're going to want to make sure
right.
that their clientele know that they're spending the money to buy whatever it is that they claim it is.
Yeah, like I'll give you an example of how valuable some of these fish are. You know, there's this famous fish market in Japan where they bring the tuna that they're going to use for sushi.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And they're worth
the bluefin tuna.
Yeah, I think one was just sold for $500,000.
Oh, yeah.
It was a 200-pound tuna. So if you want to make sure that your sushi, that's probably weigh, you know, a couple of ounces, so I don't know what it's worth, but that you're getting the real thing, you can probably do that. The Japanese will probably have them on the table soon, you know, like in a chopstick form. And
right.
you can just pick it up and it'll go beep, beep, no, no.
That's right.
Well, yes, yes.
Yeah, these are portable kits.
Right.
So anyway, these kids collected all sorts of organisms in New York City, and when they went back to the lab and they did the barcoding for this roach that they found, the barcoding showed that it was not like any roach species that had been found.
Hmm.
For, it differed by all the other roach species, and specifically the American cockroach, by 4%. 4% of its DNA was different. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but when you consider that we and the chimpanzee differ by only 1%, well, then you can imagine what that means.
Yeah, you know, they used to call them German cockroaches.
That's right. Well, no, the American is bigger. The American is what we call, when I was a kid, we called them water bugs.
Oh,
they came out of
bugs.
The sewer. They are big.
Yeah.
They can be 2 inches long, and that's
yeah.
the American cockroach. You're right. The one that you see in your kitchen usually is the German.
Yes, and the Germans call it the French cockroach.
Right. Nobody wants to take credit for these things.
Nobody wants to take credit. We should call it the Bushwick cockroach,
right.
So maybe we can put it on a logo here somewhere or something.
Republican cockroach?
Probably Republican.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so let's go on. Let's try something else that people I think are familiar with, the familiar Canada goose. We see them all over the parks.
Oh, yeah.
Many of them have stopped migrating because we feed them, which is a bad thing for them and for us. But the Canada goose has split into two separate species. This was recognized finally in 2005 by the American Ornithologist Union. They saw all of these morphological differences, these body shape differences, and DNA differences. And the new species is called the cackling goose.
Mm-hmm.
It's about half the size of a Canada goose. It looks very similar. In fact, your listeners can look on the website. There should be a photo posted of a Canada goose and a cackling goose. And the difference is that the Canada goose, which is smaller, has a different range. Remember what we said about species? Species, if you're a species, you breed among yourselves and you don't breed with somebody else. And they don't. They don't breed with the Canada goose. They stay mainly in the Pacific and the tundra. They're mm-hmm. northwest of us, way northwest. So the Canada goose stays in the U.S. and Canada. If you see a goose around here, most likely it's a Canada goose in the lower 48. But if it's in the tundra, it's going to be smaller, and it's going to be a cackling goose.
You know, so they could have done this many years ago, differentiating these geese, right? They could have taken the English-speaking geese and the French-speaking geese and divided them up in half, and you'd have the two species. They don't talk to each other, right?
But do they breed? Do they interbreed?
Oh, no. They don't even eat the same food.
Ah, French
some of
and English.
Some of them eat poutine. Anybody know what poutine is?
I don't know
is?
What poutine is.
Okay, Jack's shaking his head. If you go to Canada, buy it once just to try it. And you never buy it again. It's like taking French fries, I think, and pouring gravy on them. Is that right, Jack? And ketchup or something like that. And it's if you're hungry, it's probably very good. But that's probably the English food in Canada.
Is it like haggis?
No, haggis is a whole other story.
Oh, okay.
We won't get into haggis.
So these geese have split into two species, and to make it even more complicated, the Canada goose itself has seven subspecies. So it's dividing up even more. And the cackling goose has four subspecies. Another word for subspecies is race. Minor differences that haven't yet caused them to stop interbreeding.
So they can still breed.
They can still breed. But you see, it's a dynamic process. It's very dynamic. It can get confusing because it is so dynamic. It's fluid. Species can split into two. One can split into two. And then those two can, sometime later down the road, can meet up again, and maybe some of them can hybridize, most likely not, but it's a dynamic process.
And that just shows that you don't have to wait a million years for...
You don't have to wait a million years. I predict that there'll be more goose species forming. We have the geese that no longer migrate, and they may start breeding among themselves right here in our area, breeding before the other geese that do migrate south come back.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example of that. In fact, that's the next example I have. About birds that arrive at a breeding ground before the others do, and so they breed among themselves. Speciation due to migration differences. A little bird called the European blackcap. I'm a bird watcher. I'm a birder, and if any of you out there are, you know about this bird. It's similar to the chickadee that we have in our area, the blackcap chickadee. And it's evolved a new migratory route. Migration is very plastic. It's based on genetics, but it's very plastic. That is, it changes easily. And it has to, because if you know anything about geology, you know that the Earth is changing all the time. And the plates of the continents are moving. And so birds that migrate, any organism migrates, has to adapt over time to the changes in the Earth.
Just one little thing on that. So, you know, our famous monarch butterfly that migrates from the northeast all the way to Mexico.
Yes.
In the wintertime. People wonder why it does it and how did that start. And one idea is because of the ice age. Before the ice age, the monarch butterflies didn't migrate because the weather was nice and warm here. It was tropical all the time, right? We had these big animals running around and... they didn't migrate, but when the ice started to form and it was getting colder and colder, it forced the monarchs to go further south and further south and further south, further south. And eventually, they formed this pattern of migration.
Right, but they still come back to exploit this whole continent in the spring when they can withstand
right.
the temperature.
Yep.
Yeah, they're pretty amazing monarchs. So, this European blackcap... it's a small warbler, and normally in the spring it breeds in Germany and Austria, and it spends its winter, it's a nice life. It spends its winter in Spain and Portugal. Not a bad life. Some of them even go to North Africa. But about 50 years ago, people in England who love birds more than we do put out feeders, and they began to notice that a lot of these blackcaps were spending their winters in England. The winter in England isn't that tough, you know. It's moderate. It doesn't really get as cold as it gets here.
Yeah, they get the Gulf Stream current.
That's why. Yes,
warms it, keeps it relatively moderate.
So over time, what ended up happening and still happening is that more and more birds were spending the winter in England rather than going to Spain. Now that route from say Germany to England is much easier to migrate, much easier to fly, because they don't have to fly, number one, over the Mediterranean, which is could be nasty if there's a storm. And number two, it's a shorter distance. It's almost half the distance. It's 650 miles versus 1,000 miles. So it's an easier migration. Now, because that route is shorter when they come back to the breeding ground, and remember, they're more north in England than they would be in Spain, the day length changes more rapidly in the springtime when you're more northerly. For those reasons, they get to the breeding ground earlier in Germany.
They get the choice spots.
And they get the best spots. Mm. And they lay the most eggs. And they make the most babies. And so what's happening is they're ending up splitting from the ones that still migrate to the original migration site in Spain and Portugal. And now what's happening is we can actually see that there are morphological differences, shape differences in the bodies. The birds that stay in the UK tend to have rounded wings, which sacrifices the ability to fly long distances, but gives them increased maneuverability. Very interesting. Mm. Now that they don't eat Mediterranean olives in the winter, their bills that used to be wide are becoming a little narrower, which is better suited to catch insects, which is what their diet has become. They're also a little bit darker. So we're seeing a split right before our eyes. In the last 50 years, one species is splitting into two because of this migration difference. And again, this is a fancy name for it. I mentioned this earlier. Assortative mating in sympatry.
Uh-huh.
Meaning that they're sorting themselves out for breeding, and it's occurring even though they're living together. Sympatry, living together.
Well, at least part of the time.
At least part of the time, because, yeah. Well, they do share the mating grounds, and some of them will interbreed. They can still interbreed. But here's the most interesting part, I find.
Yeah.
The babies, the chicks that result from that, when it's time for them to migrate, they fly off kind of in an intermediate direction over the Atlantic Ocean.
Uh-huh.
Probably they don't even make it. Maybe they end up going somewhere to France. I don't know. But and they get better food there. I don't know if they get better food. But those hybrids are not reproducing. And so... the prediction is that we're going to get a real split in 50 years, which only amounts to 10 to 20 generations for this bird. Now, I know when I was here a couple of years ago, we talked a lot about evolution, and we talked about Darwin and Darwin's finches, the finches that he discovered on the Galapagos. And you just said that Carol Butler is right now in the Galapagos, and I'm sure she's seeing some of these birds and really enjoying learning firsthand the differences that Darwin saw. And let me just give you a quick rundown about these famous birds called Darwin's finches, which helped to give Darwin the insight into formulating his theory of evolution through natural selection.
Now, that's when he was traveling around the world.
On the Beagle,
this British Navy ship,
yes,
right?
The British Navy gave this ship the job of doing a survey of the coast of the Americas. And so they did a lot of traveling. And when they came to the Galapagos... Darwin, his job was to just collect and collect and collect and bring stuff back to study in England. And he found these birds that looked different, but they ended up all being evolved from one founding population. That's what he realized once he got them back to England, that one bird somehow, or a couple of birds, had gotten to the island, being blown there, to the Galapagos, and over the years they split up into 13 species on those islands.
Okay, let's stop with that, Saul, because that's a good cliffhanger. I don't know what the cliff breed is, these birds, but we'll stop there, and we'll come back for the second half of the show to solve that mystery. 13 from one.
That's right. 13 from one.
And I'll tell you a story about Darwin, how he went, when he started the trip, he was a tall guy. When he came back, he was not so tall anymore. And I'll tell you that story when we come back. Thank you. Here we are back on the air. We took our little break. The show is The Naturalist, Bernie Wides, and my special guest today is Saul
Scheinbach.
And we stopped when we got to the Galapagos Islands, and we'll send a shout out to Carol. Maybe she'll pick it up on the internet somewhere. She's there probably today. I think she was leaving last night or something like that. And Saul was going to talk about these finches, which are small. Basically, they start out as seed-eating birds, the finches with the heavy beaks. Yes, and why they changed and how they changed from one species to 13. Is that right, Saul?
That's right.
Okay, and then I'll tell you how Darwin shrunk on the way back from his trip from the Galapagos.
The Galapagos is an archipelago. It's a group of islands very close together, and these 13 species form there. There's actually one other species on another island quite a distance away. So altogether, there are 14. But if we're talking about the Galapagos, it's 13.
Let's emphasize that they're far away from any other landmass.
Right.
So they're really isolated. I think they were about 1,000 miles.
They're 600 miles off the coast of Ecuador.
Ecuador, right.
And so these birds arrived, a small group of birds arrived there maybe 2 million years ago, and guess what they found? They found these wonderful islands with no competitors, and so they could colonize the islands unimpeded and adapt on each island to the array of foods that they found in each of these new habitats. And over time, they formed these 13 species on these islands with different sized beaks and different shaped beaks. And remember, the beak of a bird is its tool. It uses that for everything. And so it's very important in determining what it's going to feed on, for sure. And we talked about this the last time I came on this show. I think it's episode 13, if people want to go and review that. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about how these 13 species formed, but what I really want to talk about is something that was found in the last 2 years. Speciation, we've been saying, is a dynamic process. We talked about the geese splitting up into two. So there's no reason why we shouldn't see Darwin's finches changing today. And in fact, if we watch them long enough, that's exactly what's been happening. There's a husband and wife team called Peter and Rosemary Grant from Princeton University. I talked about them the last time I was here. They have spent the last 40 years studying the finches. I was fortunate enough when I went to the Galapagos to actually see them on this island. They spend several months on one of the islands. No one else is allowed to go there. And Bernie thinks they're crazy because they've been doing this for so many years. But they catch every finch, every bird on the island, which amounts to, I don't know, 300-400 birds. They measure them. They take a blood sample for DNA analysis, and they band them. So they know the pedigree, the genealogy of every bird on the island. And they have gained remarkable insights about the process of evolution. And with their painstaking observations, they've witnessed the birth of a new species. They were able to see a new species arise on the island. In 1981, they captured an unusual bird, a medium ground finch, it's called, a male. It was larger, and its beak was pointier than other birds of its species. It resembled another finch, a finch called the cactus finch. That bird has a long and pointy beak because it uses it as a tool, like a needle-nose pliers, to probe flowers for pollen and nectar. The medium ground finch is a seed-eating bird, and it's got a pretty heavy, deep beak to crush seeds. Well, this bird was kind of in between. It was larger than normal, and it had a beak that was somewhat pointier. And when the Grants did a genetic analysis. They found that it was a hybrid between the medium ground finch and the cactus finch. By the way, because it had a different shaped beak, when it sang its song, the male sang his song, his courtship song, it sounded a little different.
So remind us about what a hybrid is, okay?
A hybrid is a cross between two different species, like maybe a mule is a cross between a horse and a donkey. But in this case, the hybrid, as opposed to the mule, which is sterile, in this case, these species are so closely related that a hybrid between them could still breed. Mm-hmm. And that's what this particular male was.
So the hybrids, we wouldn't call them a separate species. Distinct.
Well, you couldn't, again, when you're looking at a dynamic process, where do you stop it?
Okay.
You're looking at a movie film.
Right.
At which point do you stop and say this is when it's occurred? I guess the grants, when they published this paper, they made that decision.
Mm-hmm.
And if I go through the history that they went through, you'll see why they did it when they did it.
Mm-hmm.
This was a male that he had other genes as well, and they concluded that he was an immigrant. He landed on this island where they did been doing their studies. He came from another island, and he ended up mating with a female on the island that also was a hybrid. And since the sons of this hybrid mating all had this beak that was a little different, and they sing like their fathers, the daughters that are born listen to this song of their fathers, and they prefer that song.
Mm-hmm.
They imprint on that song. So when the daughters are ready to mate, they're looking for a male that sounds like the father. And the circumstances, therefore, seem to favor a lot of interbreeding. And that's what happened. As the Grants followed these birds, and they did this for 28 years, actually now it's 30 years, they found that in the fourth generation, a drought killed all of the descendants except a brother and a sister. And these two birds mated with each other. And now, during the ensuing 8 years and three more bird generations, these birds don't breed with anybody else. They breed among themselves.
Hmm.
And that's the hallmark of speciation. Remember what we said in the earlier program?
If they can't breed with each other, then it's a different species.
That's right. We biologists call it reproductive isolation.
Mm-hmm.
If you and I can make babies, and those babies can make babies, then we are the same species. If we can't make babies with somebody else, that's a different species. So it hasn't happened so yet that they can't make babies with other birds, but they are breeding among themselves. And the Grants call this incipient speciation.
Mm-hmm.
They're not sure if this newly formed species will emerge as a stable breeding population. The jury is out, of course.
Yeah, probably not enough numbers yet.
No, they're not enough numbers. They may not survive competition. They may not survive inbreeding. They may continue to form hybrids with other birds. They may get swallowed up by the resident populations. But whatever the outcome, you can be sure that they'll be watching. They're going to be watching this, and it will be an interesting story to follow. So here's a fine example of something that Darwin studied. Actually, it was in the 1830s that he went there, so it's 175 years ago that he went there, found these birds. These birds were instrumental in helping him formulate his theory, and people are still studying them today and learning new things, even now. And that brings me to something else that I wanted to mention, which is how Darwin fits into biology today. How does his theory fit in today? And what I can say about it is that it's a 19th century idea that explains 21st century biology.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause most Most of these techniques were unknown by him.
Right. Darwin knew nothing
about genetics.
He knew nothing about DNA. The chemical DNA was only discovered itself after he published his theory, and certainly nobody knew it was a genetic material. You know, you all learned in your high school biology about Mendel. Mendel published this paper on pea plants and something that he called factors, which we now know are genes, but nobody read it. It was published in the 1860s, and nobody read it until 30 or 40 years later. So Darwin had no idea what was causing this inheritance that he found, but he knew. He was a very smart guy, and he knew that these differences that were popping up in organisms had to be inherited. They had to be inherited, and they had to be acted on by natural selection. That was his theory. And even today, nothing that we have learned in biology contradicts Darwin's theory.
So his theory, we shouldn't really call it a theory anymore. After all these years of research and everything, because as you said in the other show, when people say theory, they think it's something that's unproved and just can't bounce that out of somebody's head.
Yes, I like to call it his big idea.
His big idea, okay.
And his big idea explains everything we are learning about biology today. In fact, it's central to biology. Without evolution, biology is merely a bunch of disconnected facts, a collection of facts out there that make no real sense unless we understand evolution. And anyone working in the field of research in biology eventually has to explain his results in the light of evolution, in terms of evolution, because that's what makes biology tick. There's a famous quote from a geneticist, and what he said was, this was Theodosius Dobzhansky, very famous geneticist, worked in Columbia University. He said, nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. And without Darwin, biology would be nowhere. It's a unifying idea.
It sort of brought together a lot of separate ideas. And as we do more and more research, it seems to be truer and truer, the things that he said, as we discover more.
Right. As I said earlier, even Newton's laws of gravity don't work at the subatomic level. And physicists had to invent quantum physics to explain what goes on with electrons and neutrons. They had to deal with probabilities.
And they're still doing that.
And they're still doing that, yes.
They say, well, it's probably going to be this way, and it's probably... So there's an example of how science changes.
Right.
You have to remember, science is dynamic. Nothing is written in stone. There's no Ten Commandments of science chiseled out in stone like the Ten Commandments of the Old Testament. I think they should use erasable markers when they write things for science, because it changes so much. But so far, Darwin's theory his big idea has held up and has been a unifying factor in most of biology.
Oh, you can bet that people are always trying to find a hole, poke a hole in it, and there's no such thing. No one has found an exception. I don't know, maybe if we find some kind of life on another planet that's not like ours at all, maybe natural selection doesn't work there. But I can't imagine it. I guess remember what Darwin said was the reason that there is a selective process is that the resources can't keep pace with the reproduction of the organisms.
Okay.
The organisms increase what's called exponentially. They go 2, 4, 8. They double. They double each time. Mm-hmm. Whereas the resources can only go up, say, by 2, 2, 4, 6, 8. So resources can't keep pace with the organisms that are breeding. And so there's always competition for resources. There's always competition for food and space. And so only the ones that are best suited to that particular environment are going to survive.
Or only the ones who can adapt.
Or have an adaptation that best fits that environment.
Right.
And Darwin ended his book with a wonderful sentence that I'd like to read. It's beautiful, poetic even. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers, having been originally breathed into a few forms, or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone circling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved. That's the last sentence of The Origin of Species.
Hmm.
Interestingly, in the second edition, because of all the pressure that he faced, Darwin added the phrase, by the Creator.
Right, because he was in this environment where religion was a very strong factor. His wife was very religious, and I think that his father was preparing, wanted him to be a minister.
Originally, he was going to be a minister.
Right.
Originally, he was going to be a physician.
Yes.
He wasn't too keen No, I think you're right. He was going to be a minister. He decided he didn't want to do that. He was going to become a physician.
Yeah.
And he went to an autopsy, He went to view surgery.
Yeah.
This is before the time of anesthetic.
Right.
And so somebody was losing a limb, and he just walked out. He couldn't handle it.
No, he better off with cockroaches and other little.
Well, I became a microbiologist because they don't, these bacteria don't bleed.
Right.
They don't scream and they don't bleed. You can do all sorts of experiments with them.
Yeah. So it's easier dealing with them also than with some of these bigger critters. So we start out with Darwin and we end up with Darwin.
That's right.
Because there's so much... if you look at a pyramid and you turn the pyramid upside down, Darwin is carrying the pyramid on his shoulders. How's that?
That's a good way. He's got the tree of life. The tree of life is the only illustration in The Origin of Species.
Yep.
He drew it by hand. I saw what he had drawn. I think it was in the Museum of Natural History. They had a special exhibit on Darwin about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he drew that for the book. And that's the only illustration, is the tree of life. And we should all keep that in mind, that we are just one leaf on one little twig on a branch that stems from this tree of life.
That's right. And I remember... who was that famous biologist that died? Gould was his name?
Stephen Jay Gould.
Stephen Jay Gould. I remember him saying, just by chance, we were on the right twig of the right branch to evolve into what we are today.
That's right.
If we were on a different branch and that branch evolved into critters, they wouldn't look anything like us. And about this idea of finding life somewhere else, well... I don't know what the religious folks are going to say. They'll probably say that, it's part of God's universe or something like that. But we are fairly close to discovering life on other places, on Mars especially. We're going to send up another probe up to Mars because we know that there's frozen water at the poles in Mars. And life as we know it needs a water, some kind of way to transport energy. And carbon-based molecules. Is that right, Saul?
Pretty sure that it would be carbon-based.
Carbon-based, because that's what we're made out of, hydrocarbons and all of those carbon molecules.
I think it's a good bet that we'll find life on Mars, but it's not going to be aliens like we see in movie theaters. It's going to be microbes. It's going to be some kind of bacteria that are living deep under the crust and have managed to survive because that's what will be there.
Okay, but so we're dealing with a lot of unknowns, and we're just starting to explore the rest of our solar system. Forget about the rest of the universe. We're still in our solar system because we have this This moon of is Jupiter's moon?
Yes, Io. Io is a fascinating place. There's a probe that went out recently and did a bypass of this moon of Jupiter and discovered that there's water on this moon. In fact, it's covered in water, except it's so cold out there that it's all ice. The ice, it's a huge, very thick crust of ice. But the interior of the moon is generating heat because the tug between the moon and Jupiter is so great. Remember, Jupiter is a massive planet. I think it's 100 times the size of Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Its gravity is so massive that it tugs on the moon and moves the core around inside and generates a lot of heat.
Yeah.
So what astrophysicists speculate now is that there's water underneath all that water ice.
Mm-hmm.
There's liquid water. And Bernie, you just said that that's the prerequisite for life as we know it. So I can imagine, I hope it happens within my lifetime. I don't know if it will. We can send a probe up there that crashes through the ice and goes down into this watery moon and finds the kinds of things that we have found here on our own planet. These so-called hydrothermal vents,
mm-hmm.
where heat is coming up from the core of the Earth, deep down in the ocean, a mile or 2 miles down. And guess what's around all of these vents?
Hydrothermophilic critters.
Thermophilic, yeah.
Yes.
Creatures that love heat.
Right.
And the base of that community is bacteria.
Right.
Heat-loving bacteria that grow and they support shrimp and crabs and tube worms and all sorts of organisms that no one could have imagined existed. You know, when I took biology in high school, we learned that all living things get energy ultimately from the sun. Because even if you just ate meat, the meat came from something that ate plants, and plants get their energy from the sun. These communities get all of their energy from the hydrothermal vents. It's chemical energy.
Mm-hmm.
They use the chemicals that come up from the interior of the Earth, the microbes do, and they split these molecules, like hydrogen sulfide, that smelly stuff that comes from rotten eggs. They split it off, they gain energy from it, and they grow. And they are the basis for the food chain deep down in the ocean.
Yes, and it's one theory of where life may have started on the Earth.
Exactly.
In the deep oceans. And the other theory is in the shallow seas, where there were these cyanobacteria that learned how to do photosynthesis. But we'll save that for another show. I think we did enough for today. I just wanted to tell you that story about Darwin. Darwin was a very tall guy. I think he was about 6'4". And when he shipped out on the Beagle, if you've ever been on a boat, even on a fancy boat, you know the bunks are not too big. So you'd have a tough time.
I had a tough time.
On the boat. And Darwin was on the Beagle for three years or 5 years. I don't remember how long it was. But it was a long voyage. And he couldn't fit into his bunk too well because he was 6'4". So what they had to do was, there was a chest that was next to the bed. They had to cut out an opening in the chest so he could put his feet through it. But he still couldn't straighten out. So by the time he came back from spending 5 years scrunched up on the Beagle, when he got off the ship, he was shorter than when he left because he had to sleep in that position. So Darwin lost a little bit of his height. So I don't know if that's a folktale or that's true, but he spent a long time on the Beagle and collected everything in sight and brought it all back.
An adaptation. That was an adaptation. He got shorter.
That's right.
He had to fit his environment.
That's right. And we don't have time at all to talk about Wallace, who was this other scientist who had the same theory as Darwin.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons Darwin published his theory, because he was worried that Wallace was going to publish it first.
And scoop him.
Right. So and so Darwin's wife said, time to do it. And she kept...
Well, his friends also, his colleagues, they all knew he had been mulling this over for decades.
Right.
And he had written some stuff, but he hadn't published it. And when they got... What happened was the Royal Society got a manuscript from Wallace.
Right.
And they said, oh my God, this is just what Darwin has been telling us. So they came to Darwin, they said, look, we know that you've been thinking about all this for so long. We can't give you priority, that is, let you publish and not him. He came up with this similar idea. So what we're going to do is we're going to publish both papers. You write your paper. We're going to publish them both side by side. But and that's what they did. But because everyone in the field knew that Darwin had been doing this for so long, much longer than Wallace, they gave him, in the end, they gave him the priority. And so it's Darwin's theory of natural selection, not Wallace's theory of natural selection.
It could have been easy enough.
It could have been. That's right.
Yes. So I think we're going to wrap this show up in a minute. And I want to thank Saul for coming down today.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
And maybe in another year or two, Saul will come back and give us the latest information on life that we're going to find on Io.
That would be great. Io. That would be great. Yeah. I'd love to report that.
Yes. But who knows? We never know what's going to happen even tomorrow. We don't know. So
check those cockroaches in your kitchen.
Right. And I hope you enjoyed the show. We got a little technical, but there's no way around it. When you're talking about science, you have to use some of those nice technical terms.
Like cockroach,
yeah. So it's Bernie Wides and
Saul Scheinbach
signing off the area, off the program today, with the same music.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.